Hi, I'm Allison Jacobson. I'm alcoholic. And my sobriety date is the 5th of June, 1993. My home group meets Tuesday nights. It's the Buckingham Group. We meet in Buckingham Courthouse, Virginia. We are a step discussion group, and once a month we do a tradition. If anybody has a reason to be in Buckingham Courthouse on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m., we sure hope you come by and see us. Some of you in this room already do come there regularly. It's been my home group for probably 16 or 17 years now. I was trying to think about that this morning. I think my husband and I were thinking that group started about 17 years ago. And I've only had one other home group prior to this one. And it's definitely not the most perfect home group, but it's perfect for me. I wanted to thank Sam for asking me to come speak. He had to work tonight, but I love coming out here, and particularly today. I always get to meet with a very good friend of mine, and I just really enjoy it, and I enjoy this group very, very much. And I'm always very humbled when I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I mean that because towards the end of my drinking, the last few years of my drinking, I wasn't even invited home for Christmas. So to be asked to do anything, I tell you what, if I'm able to, I always say yes. I started being detached from you way before I had a drink. When I was growing up, and I'm sure I've heard this said many, many times by other people, and I'm not going to say at like 10, 11, 12 years old, it was a conscious thought in my mind, I don't fit in or anything like that. I had friends. I just, on the inside, felt very separated from you, and there was always a dis-ease that I felt. Now, I couldn't have told you back then that, oh, God, I need a drink, I need something, you know, I need something to take this edge off. I didn't even know I had an edge. I just thought that I was unhappy and in a bad mood for a lot of the time, most of the time. I heard somebody say once they were born feeling bad, and I'm not going to go that far and say that. I don't think that's the truth. But definitely at age 11 and 12, I just felt uncomfortable. That's the best way I can put it. I felt incredibly uncomfortable. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic of my type, the time and place is going to present itself where you are able to be introduced to the effect produced by alcohol. And when I was introduced to that effect, I absolutely loved it. One of my favorite parts in the book is in the doctor's opinion, where it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I would say that I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Not in the very beginning, but certainly by the time I was 20, I was drinking for oblivion until I stopped drinking when I was 27. I was definitely an oblivion, blackout, morning, you name it, drinker. But when I was introduced to the effect produced by alcohol, I was very young. I was about 13. I lived in upstate New York with my mother. My parents by then were already divorced, and I had a very cantankerous relationship with my mom. I would blame her well into my 30s for every bad circumstance that I perceived took place in my life, right down to not being able to balance a checkbook. It was her fault. And so I was living with her. She was a single mom. She was gone a lot. And so, you know, opportunities presented themselves. And a lot of my friends, their moms were single moms. So we all had a lot of this extra time on our hands to get into trouble. And a girlfriend of mine and I had planned this double date, and I remember this day like it was yesterday. I even remember what I was wearing, jeans and a pink shirt. I used to call it my unlucky shirt because every time I wore that shirt, something bad happened. Never mind, every time I wore that shirt, I was usually drinking and something bad happened. When I walked out of the house sober in that shirt, oddly enough, nothing bad happened. But we were planning this double date, and my friend Jennifer got a fake ID, and we took, you know, we stole whatever alcohol was in our parents' homes, that kind of thing. And we were by the railroad tracks by this canal, and I had 4 Molson Goldens, a flask of Burgundy, and a flask of vodka, and thought nothing of it. And I will tell you, about an hour into that evening, I not only did I feel comfortable, did I feel relaxed, all of a sudden I felt funny, I felt thin, I felt pretty, and I was even beginning to get this attitude of arrogance. I was feeling better than you, whereas most of the time I walked around feeling far less than you. But with a few drinks in me, well, more than a few, I felt far better than you. And I just felt like I could take on the world, you know? And so I did. I took it on face down, vomiting and having an ambulance called in my behalf. And I got taken home in an ambulance, and my mom and my aunt stayed up with me while I got sick all night. And I knew the next day I was going to just be in so much trouble. You know, my mom and I didn't really get along anyway. We had a hard time liking each other, and this wasn't going to help the situation. And knowing all that, I knew I was going to drink again because I thought, God, that was just awesome. You know, I didn't say that in my 13-year-old mind, but I loved it. And I didn't start drinking every day. I didn't start drinking in the morning. I really basically drank maybe once a month when we could all get it. Or back then, the laws were far laxer and the licenses were far different. You could actually make a fake ID up in your bedroom and nobody cared. Now I don't know how anybody would manage to do it. I'm sure they do, but it was just so much easier back then. And so I probably drank about once a month, and every time I drank, consequences occurred. You know, they weren't huge, but they occurred. And then slowly but surely, you know, my friend's parents told them they couldn't hang around me. I was a bad influence. And it was interesting because I didn't see myself that way. You know, I can't see the truth about me. I thought I was a nice girl. You know, I came... Both my parents were college graduates. They were divorced, but they both worked. They had decent jobs. And so I thought, why am I the bad seed, you know, that these people are telling, you know, these parents are telling their kids they can't hang around with? But I was, because every time their kids were with me, the police were involved or, you know, something was involved. Shoplifting from the JCPenney's, you know, they might have gotten a phone call from JCPenney. And, so little by little, things were happening. And meanwhile, back in my home, my mother and I, we were getting into physical altercations. I was calling her every name in the book. She was actually afraid of me. And it's not something I'm proud of. As a matter of fact, I felt horrible about it when I got sober. She would go to bed at night, and she would bring herself and her purse in her bedroom and lock her room. And that's how we lived. And so obviously, you know, living like that it's not feasible for the long term. I often think my mom at that time was the age I am now. And if I had to go to bed every night with, you know, my purse and all my belongings locked in my room, I wouldn't want to live like that either. I had a party one night when she was out of town visiting her sister. A neighbor called her. She came home, and the next day I was on a plane to Virginia. I think I was 13 and a half years old. I didn't think she was going to follow through because she had threatened me so many times. If you do this again, you're going to go live with your father in Virginia. If you do this, you're going to go live with your father in Virginia. And the next morning she said, "Are you packed?" And I'm like, "No." You know, I was so surly and so arrogant. She's like, "Well, you need to get packed because we're going to the airport now." And I probably, you know, said some sort of expletive that I normally do. And I believed I was on my way to Virginia when I got on the plane and I actually landed in Virginia. And so that's how I ended up here. And I've actually been here ever since. I was just starting high school, and it's funny, water seeks its own level, and within a week, I was running with the same kind of people that I was running with in New York. Wherever you go, there you are, and I'm a big fan of the fresh start. I just wish that I had known way back then that wherever I went, there I was, and it would have saved me a lot of time. My sponsor says that they should put these signs on, what states is it? I think it's California, Florida, Arizona, and maybe another nice state that, like, when you're crossing the state border, it says this state doesn't work either. And I wish somebody had said that to me. I wasn't a big state hopper, but I was a big relationship, job, college hopper, all that kind of stuff. And I wish somebody, I don't think I would have listened. I didn't listen to anybody, and I still have a hard time listening today, but it just would have been maybe useful information. But that's how I got here. And I'll never forget, my dad was a Naval Academy graduate, and he's real structured, very disciplined, and gave me the big lecture. He was famous for his big lectures. I used to listen to them so drunk sometimes, and if I was drunk, I didn't care, but if I needed to be a little more drunk, I did care, and I could just hear him. And he told me in the car, I know you're smoking cigarettes. I know you've dropped all the good habits that you used to have, and we're not going to be doing that here. And in my mind, I'm just like, oh, my God, give me a break. And I was still hungover from the night before, that party I had. And I just, I was thinking in my mind, whatever. And I just had to get a feel for the lay of the land. And then once I felt comfortable, within a week, I was sneaking out of the house. I was stealing his cigarettes. Rather than going to the store and stealing them, I was stealing his. And it was just, I always stayed one step ahead of him. And it drove him insane. And back then, in high school, there was big parties. And I told you, I'm dating myself. But back when I was growing up, you could go to the grocery store and you could take these big bottles of Budweiser and go into the ladies' room, drink them, and walk out of the store. And nobody said anything. And now, they've got cameras everywhere. And so that's what my friends and I did. And I'm sure the people at the grocery store knew, but that's what we did. And we changed grocery stores. We changed different Giants, and they didn't have Kroger back then. It was Giant and another store. And we would go there and pick these big bottles of Budweiser up, drink them down real fast, steal some cigarettes, and go to our party. And when I was 17 years old, I was at a grain alcohol party. It was February of probably 1983, I want to say. And I got into a very, very bad car accident leaving the party. And, I never think anything is my fault, because it never was. And so a friend of mine was driving, and we hit a telephone pole head-on, going 40 miles an hour. And really what saved us was that we were so drunk, with all that beer and grain alcohol in us. Well, you only had to tell me that once, because what I told my dad was, if I wasn't drunk, I'd be dead. And he was probably thinking, oh, I wish you were. But he took me by that telephone pole, and I was so drunk. I didn't come to until I came to in the hospital, and they were squeezing glass out of my forehead and my head, and my friend almost died. The steering wheel, it was just awful. It was an awful, awful accident, and I had absolutely not one ounce of remorse associated with it, not one, because I wasn't driving. Jennifer was driving, and I have to remember, now I'm a parent, and I think, my parents actually had remarried at the time. It was their brief remarried period, and then they were to get divorced yet again. And they got a call from the hospital, and the hospital did not tell them whether me and my friend were dead or alive. They actually had to drive all the way to the hospital without knowing that information. I don't even know. I probably would pass out of sheer terror if I got a call like that about my son, and I didn't care about that either. They tried to talk to me reasonably, and in one ear and right out the other. And what did happen, though, and it was a rather large resentment for me, was my friend's mother agreed with our high school to bring the car that we, so nicely totaled and have it sit in front of the high school so we could be an example of the drunk drivers. I thought, U-B-I-T-C-H, I couldn't believe it. I just absolutely couldn't believe it. And I'm not going to say from the day I was born, but certainly from prior to my ingesting alcohol and right up to this minute as I stand here, I have been incredibly selfish and self-centered. It was incredibly difficult for me to even think about you. you weren't on my radar screen. You just didn't register with me. And it's, I remember for a long time, I came in and out of AA for 9 years. And I remember for a very, very long time when I finally came and stayed, sort of thinking to myself, I wonder why this time it worked. And it wasn't this time that Alcoholics Anonymous worked, because Alcoholics Anonymous has worked far before I ever walked through the door. It's just that I never understood what the problem was, and therefore I couldn't understand what the solution was. For years, way back, probably when I was 17, it occurred to me that I didn't drink like other people, except maybe my friend Jennifer, who hit the telephone pole. You know, she and I seem to be very well matched in that arena. But most people that I hung around with, most men that I dated, nobody seemed to drink the volume and, you know, the quantity that I did. I used to wear it as a badge of honor. And so what I thought for a very, very long time was that if I could just, it never occurred to me to stop drinking, because who would do that? But what it did occur to me was I needed to sort of change the amount that I took, change the consequences that were happening around me, slow down a little bit. I thought drinking was the problem. And drinking wasn't the problem at all. Drinking was the solution to a spiritual problem that I didn't know I had. And if you had told me back when I was 17 years old, Allison, you're suffering from a spiritual disconnect, I would have told you where to go and how to get there, maybe. I didn't understand that at all. And so how I tried to tackle this situation, as many of you probably have tried as well, I tried to tackle it through self-help books, the psychic hotline, psychiatrists, psychologists. I'm not kidding. I called the psychic hotline every night, drunk as a skunk, and put my faith in them. So there you go. No wonder everything got so screwed up. But I looked outside for some type of power to fix me. And I didn't even know what was going on. That was the deal. I had no idea that I was absolutely disconnected from you. I couldn't even imagine any kind of connection with a God of my misunderstanding or my understanding. That wasn't even really in my consciousness at the time. And so I didn't understand that when I drank, I became a part of. I drank to be included. You know, when I drank, it was like, all right, let's get up and go. Let's do something. When I first got sober, I thought, how in the world am I going to drive? I drive way better drunk than I do sober. I drove a stick shift, and I didn't think I was going to be able to drive it, quite frankly. And it was just insane. But when I drank, I felt a part of the world. I felt like everything was going to be okay. I didn't have a care in the world until I woke up the next morning. But it was just, that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Of course, we overshoot the mark, but we do. But it was like, that's what I was aiming for, that sense of ease and comfort. And I told you, way back when I was an early teenager, I knew I was uncomfortable. And alcohol was, boy, that landed right in my lap. And that made me feel okay. You know, sometimes I felt like I could take on the world. You know, I felt just incredibly more powerful than what I ever would be. But so I would come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would wonder why, after being sober for, and I'm not kidding you, like 4 days or a week, or, you know, sometimes it was a lot longer, I couldn't understand why things were worse, you know, and they were worse. I have actually contemplated suicide not while drinking, but while stone cold sober, you know. I never thought about suicide when I was drunk. I think alcohol saved me from all of that. My thoughts of suicide have come when I'm not drinking and when I am an absolutely untreated alcoholic. That's far more dangerous to me And I never understood that. I don't know if anybody explained it to me. I went to meetings all the time. I lived in Northern Virginia, and there are meetings around the clock, you know. I went to more meetings then than I do now. I go to at least 4 and sometimes 5 and 6 when that's available to me, but always, always, I never go below 4. And here I was in Northern Virginia going to a meeting every single day and wondering why I feel way worse now than last month when I was out of a job and didn't know, you know, how I was going to get my next 12-pack and pack of cigarettes. It was horrible. And so, of course, you know, I would return to what I know. I would return to my solution. And my solution was get drunk and figure it out later. That was my motto. I'll just get drunk now and I'll just worry about this later. And my family, my godparents, everybody that was immediately around me or in contact with me begged me to stop drinking. You know, can't you see what you're doing? You're such a smart person. You could do this. You could do that. I dropped out of college because that got involved with my drinking. I don't even know how I got into a college, quite frankly. I don't even know how I got out of high school, but somehow I did. And everything I did when I went away to school, I broke every moral code I had in my mind. And, you know, I'd have this bar of standards, this mental bar of standards, and I would say to myself, if I ever do this, I might think about stopping drinking, or I might think about slowing down. I don't think I ever told myself I would stop, but I would think about slowing down. You know, when I went away to school and I was away from that parental, you know, closing in on me, I just broke loose, absolutely loose. And in this day and age, I think, God, I'm lucky I'm alive now, because it just doesn't seem to work that way anymore. You can't really pass out in the middle of a field all night and nobody bother you, you know, but somehow that happened to me. But so I broke all my codes, and yet I didn't slow down. I didn't stop, nothing, you know. I just, what I did was I just kept lowering the code until there was no code. That's what I did, and that's how I lived. And I remember when I first walked in here, and I did not stay, but I felt lower than low. And I just remember thinking, ugh, you know, 50 million showers are not going to make me feel better about myself. I didn't want to look in the mirror. I just disgusted my own self. And I remember, and I never want to forget this, there was a time, you know, I had my whole circuit of like 7-Elevens and stuff that I would buy alcohol from, because I didn't want to go into any one of them 2 nights in a row. I don't know why. I would always go into them drunk anyway. And this one man behind the counter, this had to be 20-some-odd years ago, he looked at me. He took one look at me, and I wasn't even drunk. And this is what's so funny, what we tell ourselves. I wasn't even drunk, but I really needed to be drunk. And he looked at me, and under his breath, but he clearly said it loud enough for me to hear, he said, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." And I wanted to die. And I just thought, oh. And I remember getting in my car, and my solution for that is, well, I'm never going to that flipping 7-Eleven again, you know. And that's what I have to say to myself to feel better. And except nothing made me feel better, you know. I was getting to the point the last year, definitely 6 months, but maybe a year of my drinking, nothing made me feel better. Even getting drunk made me feel worse, you know. It was just, oh, it was awful. I was introduced to AA. My father was in AA, so it wasn't like I was a stranger to Alcoholics Anonymous. My car accident when I was 17, my friend and I had to go to 2 AA meetings. God, now you'd go to 50, but we had to go to 2. And I remember thinking to myself, people in these meetings were as old as I am now, and I thought, well, maybe when I'm that age, I'm married, I have a few kids, if I still have a drinking problem, maybe I'll go to AA, you know? And I always like to say as a disclaimer, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed, I was single and childless. And I always like to think that that's because nobody would legally bind themselves to me. And nobody would have. So it was funny, you know, that I thought I'd end up here when I'm old, married, you know, and I came in here young and single. And I didn't think Alcoholics Anonymous worked. You know, I've been through 4 treatment centers, several detoxes. I told you about the psychiatrist and the psychologist. I was out of hope is what was going on. I probably talked way too much and listened far too little because I don't ever recall hearing a message of depth and weight like I did. Actually, it was in 1992. I heard a message of depth and weight in 1992, and I wasn't to get sober in 1993, but part of what helped me get sober in 1993 was that message that was carried to me in 1992. And I'll speed up to that. I was, when I drank, I liked to play drunk and dial, and all that amounted to was like around midnight, between midnight and 2, some lucky person would get a phone call from me. And you know, it was usually a family member. And I would tell them how, you know, they've ruined my life if it was my mother or my father. And this night, though, this was very odd. This night, I called my brother. And my brother was living at the time in Cumberland, Maryland, and he was working at this wilderness school. And anyhow, I called him, and I said, you know, Stephen, I just want to kill myself. I, for me, when I say that to somebody, it means I need attention. I don't think I really wanted to kill myself that night. Obviously, I'm standing here, but I just felt so bad, and I did not know how to convey that. And so I just said, you know, I just want to die. And at this point, I think I'm only 25 or 26. And but with no hope, you know, living to my 80s or 90s seems like a very long life. And so that's what I said to him. And out of his mouth was, you know, Alison, my boss is an Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's into the big book. And he's going to this Joe and Charlie seminar this weekend. Would you go if he can get you in? I thought I was really going to kill myself. I thought, oh, my God. I thought I clearly, like, called the wrong family member this evening. And, I mean, I'm not kidding. I actually might have even sobered up a little bit. I was like, oh, no. And what do you say? You know, I'm a people pleaser by nature, so I'm going to have to go to this thing. And at this point in my mind, I'm trying to negotiate, like, how long am I going to go? You know, am I going to go the whole darn weekend? I don't even know this person. And it's funny, because this person is the man I'm married to today, you know? And that's how I met my husband. And, gosh, and when I met him, it's not that his life was perfect, because it was not. He was the first person, though, that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous who had hope, who was happy about being sober, who talked about Alcoholics Anonymous in the terms that I know it today, that it's not just about put the plug in the jug and go to a meeting and, you know, just endure. I mean, he was really excited. He was talking about tapes and conventions and loaded me up with all this stuff. And I was like, whoo. And he had these, I always give him a shout out because he still does it. And I think he's beginning to do it again now. He had all these acronyms. And I met him and he was far more zealous than he is now. I don't know if it's just age or I don't know what it is, but he would be like, Alison, you know what the acronym for STEPS is? And I'd be like, I don't even know up from down right now. You know, I'm like recovering from the hangover from the night before. And he's like, solution to every problem, sober. Oh, and he just laughed. And you know what nuts is? Not using the steps. Oh. And I thought he was a nut. I did. I did not like him at first. It took me a year to date him. And but what resonated with me was, I told you, he was the first person that I met that loved Alcoholics Anonymous through and through. You know, and he told me about what was going on in his life. He had a lot of financial amends to make. It wasn't like he was resentment free. He's a very intense kind of guy, but he loved Alcoholics Anonymous and he believed in it. And I don't know, something just, I thought, holy crow, either I've just been comatose for the past 9 years or 8 years or You know, something was different about him than the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had met. And obviously, you know, I remembered it a year later when we ran into each other at a Joe and Charlie seminar, and I don't know if he just wore me down, but I started dating him. And my last drunk was June 4th, 1993. And the mistake I made, and I see other people make it, rather than do the work myself, I just figured, well, Al's real into AA. I'll just let him do the work, and I'll just see what flows my way. You know, I'll just get it from osmosis, I suppose. I don't know what I was thinking. I get in the car. I go to lots of meetings. I didn't really have a sponsor to speak of. I wasn't too sure if I felt like doing an inventory, you know, all this stuff. I had Alcoholics Anonymous on my terms for a very long time, and that's not the way to go. The best way to come here is out of answers and very willing. But I woke up one morning. I decided I feel irritable, restless, discontent. It's not like I just decided. I did feel that way. It had been coming a long time. You know, nothing ever just happens. Nobody ever just gets drunk. Oh, I don't know what happened. They just got drunk. Well, I know what happened. There's a lot of things that happened. A, B, C, and D were in place before they went out and purchased the alcohol. That's the last deal on the end of that train. But so I went and I got drunk, and my husband came home, and he got the cash, which was already in my wallet. He asked me if I needed some more alcohol because he didn't want me to get a DUI. And I was very offended by that. If I need any, I'll get my own, you know, whatever. And he said something to me that evening that, well, obviously I still remember it. It resonated with me. He said, "You can drink or you cannot drink. That's your business." Nobody had said that to me. Everybody, I was used to people begging me to not drink. And here's somebody saying, "You can drink, you cannot drink. It's your business." And he said, "But if you're going to drink, then we're done," is basically the synopsis of that conversation. And he, you know, generally means what he says and says what he means. So I knew he wasn't kidding around with me. And so I thought, okay, I guess I am going to have to endure. I guess I'm not going to drink. And so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, not really with an honest desire to stop drinking, but with an honest desire to save my relationship with my husband, who was then my boyfriend. And I'm a firm believer. I don't think it really matters what brings you here, but something has to happen if you're going to stay here. And something had to happen with me. And our literature says that something is an entire psychic change. And, you know, if you have it, then you're lucky to stay. If you don't have it, then you'll probably be drinking again or something far worse, I think. But so that's what our literature says. There's lots of warnings in our book. You know, we must live by a spiritual basis of life or else. Our third step is promptly followed by, you know, by action, a rigorous attempt to be honest. There's all sorts of things. Nobody really talks about it. People say, "Oh, God, don't talk about God. Oh, God, don't talk about the steps. I'm not ready for a fourth step. My so-and-so said I'll drink if I do that fourth step." Really? Because my experience has been if I didn't do that fourth step, I kept getting drunk. You know, that was my experience. And so I tend to tell people the way I was taught. And people cared enough about me to tell me the truth about my alcoholism. And what they told me was that we have it is a suggested program of action, but it's the only suggested program of action in all of our literature. So there's one suggestion, and either we take it or we don't. And I find it funny how people want to fight about that. Well, it's only suggested. The steps are only suggested, but they're the only suggestion. And so I got to this point in sobriety again. It was like it was the lottery. You know, my number would just come up every now and then. I wish if I really played lotto, I wish my number would come up. It never has. But it would come up in the drunk pool quite a bit. And this time, I don't know. I did do something different that I do know what happened. Rather than going in, you know, going to the store when the irritable, restless, and discontent came on, I called somebody and I humbled up and I told them what was going on in my life. you know. I coasted through the first several years of my sobriety just doing just barely enough to get by. I was still wrought with resentment. I was still wrought with a lot of spiritual illness. There was a big wall between me and you, and there was a big wall between me and God. I have an awful lot of pride, and it's not like I've done anything bombastic. I haven't murdered anybody. It's the little ankle biter stuff that I worry about what you'll think of me. And then I decide I'm going to keep a secret, and it's okay. Nobody has to know, you know, blah, blah. Well, then 3 years later, that secret is really eating my lunch, and all of a sudden I can't make eye contact with you, and all of a sudden I can't even make eye contact with people at work, and all of a sudden I'm starting to avoid my husband, and all of a sudden life just stinks, you know? And then all of a sudden I decide that it's a really good idea to run away, leave my job, and become a yoga teacher in Boston. I don't know a soul in Boston, but the yoga person that I admire has a studio in Boston, so I just knew I was destined to work there. And you know what I'm destined to do? His DVDs in my living room. That's what I'm destined to do. And if I don't do those, I'm going to suffer from another ailment. But anyway, so I'm like 10 years sober, coasting through Alcoholics Anonymous, starting to stockpile some secrets, and I'm just so agitated. I don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. And at that point, you know, I don't want to drink, but I don't want to come clean either. You know, I don't want to, how do you go to your sponsor who you love and say, you know what, I just am not always honest with you. This is what goes on inside of my head, blah, 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 blah. I had far too much pride for that. So how that played out was I fired my sponsor and I asked my husband for a divorce, you know. When I am not tending to my spiritual condition daily, it comes out everywhere. I tell the ladies I sponsor, you either pay the piper now or you pay the piper later, but you're always going to pay. So you choose. I choose now. I prefer to deal with things as they occur. I think maybe my husband might think I deal with a little too much as it occurs. He was telling our friend Helen, who watches our son, he's like, oh, if that were Allison, she would have just already confronted me about that. But, you know, I'd rather live that way than the way I used to live. The way I used to live, why be sober? Why be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? I ended up at 10 years sober. I told you I fired my sponsor, Nancy, and I asked my husband for a divorce because the way I operated back then, when I was full of pain or I'm full of secrets, rather than coming clean and being honest, I'm going to make you feel like it's your fault. I'm going to make you feel like you've damaged me in some way. I'm going to make you feel like you're less of a person, you know, because I just... stone cold sober, can't stand myself again. I felt like I did in the last months of my drinking. And it was more palpable when I was in the last months of my drinking than when I'm stone cold sober. And I just didn't know what to do. I just felt absolutely fraudulent. And I felt fraudulent because I was fraudulent. And, you know, it's, even though that period was very painful for me, it was the darkest time I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the best time I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took the steps as they're outlined in the book. I withheld nothing. It was the first time in my whole life, adult or young, that I was free. And I felt that freedom, and I'm still free today. There are at least two or three people in this world that know absolutely everything there is to know about me. Good, bad, and who cares? And I'm happy about that. I used to walk around with nobody knowing. And I remember, talk about dark, I used to think, God, if I die tomorrow, all this crap's going to come out and everybody's going to know I'm a fraud. And I used to get really worried. I think I better take really good care of myself so I can clean up this mess. It's just strange. You know, I don't have to walk around feeling that way today. And so I cleaned stuff up and I did an honest inventory, and I shared it with a woman that Randy knows. And And she directed me into the amends. And I had to make amends to my husband. You know, I'd made this mess of my marriage and made him just feel so horrible. Sometimes when I'm driving down the road and I think about it, I start crying just because I just can't believe I created that mess, but I did. And so I made amends to him. And I went around making amends to other people. I started really working with women that I was sponsoring and taking them through the book, teaching them what I know, helping them treat their alcoholism. And I was told that the way to stay free is to always be willing and able to help another alcoholic. And so I always have been. I've always remained willing. Sometimes I look at my phone and I think, oh, and it's not like it rings all the time. It does not. But it seems to ring when I don't want it to. You know, has anybody ever experienced that? And so many people have taken so many hours of their personal time and helped me with my stuff that I will gladly do that for other people. And it took my husband and I think, probably 2 years to be comfortable in our marriage again. It was funny. We were having a conversation just the other day that if all that mess hadn't have happened 10 years ago, you know, our marriage is better today than it was right before that mess happened. And I'm sure that right before that mess happened, he thought it was pretty good. Yeah, I remember him telling me that. He was like, this is absolutely coming out of the blue. What in the H-E-double-L is going on? And at least now he's married to somebody that he can trust. He's married to somebody that, you know, what you see is what you get. I don't think he's like searching around the house thinking, oh God, is there like some credit card I don't know about? Is there, you know, I don't think he even knows the password to my email. He doesn't need to check my email. He doesn't need to check my phone. And I don't think I've ever done that to him. It wouldn't occur to me to do that kind of thing. And I like living that way. My life today is exciting to me, but it's probably boring to the casual observer. And I love it. I just love it. The less drama I have in my life, the better. I did get a bolt out of the blue that I'll talk a little bit about. In December, yeah, you knew I'd talk about that. I'm adopted, and I have never cared that I was adopted. It's never been a thing for me. All these psychiatrists who wanted to diagnose me when I was drinking, they're like, oh, you have an attachment disorder. You're adopted. Honest to heaven, as I stand here before you today, I have never cared. You know, I have never cared. Even my mother, as much as we didn't get along, and we are not close today, but we do have a relationship. I was incredibly close with my father, and we were clear with each other right down to the day he died, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I have never been unhappy about the family I grew up in, none of it. I just never even thought about that. And 10 years ago, my biological mom found me. You know, now with the internet, you can find anybody, I suppose. It's like the world's closing in. It was very weird. And I got to know the roots of my alcoholism some. I've got two biological brothers who, quite frankly, after meeting them, I'm happy I was adopted. And I just am. I will tell you, I'd be drunk in Arkansas right now if I hadn't been, you know. And they've got a pretty good gig. Their mom buys their alcohol. She pays for their rent, their groceries. She delivers their groceries. And I think, how did I miss out on that? You know, my family wouldn't have given me a dime. And thank heaven they didn't, because them refusing to bail me out saved my life. And anyway, I was going to my P.O. box like I do every day, and I got a card from my biological dad. And it was weird. A whole can of worms was open with my biological mom, and I'm grateful that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous when all this happened, because heaven knows what would have happened if I'd be drinking. And it's really strange. You know, my dad that raised me, I was incredibly close with, and when he died, it was very, very difficult. It was just very hard on me. And it's kind of funny how God works. I have a second shot at having a relationship with a dad, and we get along really, really well. and I've been out to meet him and his wife, and it's just kind of neat, you know. When my other dad died, I just thought, well, shoot, you know, Al and Jake, well, Jake wasn't alive back then, but I thought, well, that's my family, and that would have been fine by me. That would have been perfect, but now I have an opportunity to have an extended family, and I'm very, very excited for my son. I told my son about it, and, you know, he's not even five yet, and he's like, I have a grandpa, because he's never met, you know, he didn't have any grandparents when he was born, and so it's just pretty exciting that if you live long enough and stay sober long enough, what the universe plops in your lap. And, you know, sometimes when I'm driving down the road, I think, AA, when I got here, I wanted you to show me, first I wanted you to show me how to drink without consequence. Then I realized that wasn't going to be happening. And I just wanted you to show me how to drink and maybe not always be dying to have a drink. And what I've come to believe now is Alcoholics Anonymous, yes, you know, I don't have the desire to drink. The obsession to drink has been removed. And obviously, since the obsession has been removed, I haven't set off the allergy. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live. I didn't know how to live. You know, if you've got a spiritual illness, you probably don't have many tools in that toolkit to teach you how to live. And far more has come down the pike with me in sobriety than I could have ever imagined when I was drinking. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know what to do. And if I don't know what to do, I know who to call. And they can direct me to what to do. My sponsor's favorite direction for me, and I don't mind saying it, is whatever you do, don't open your mouth. Because I have, that's her favorite direction for me. I have a short temper and a quick fuse. And, you know, restraint of pen and tongue in our 11th step is one of the best directions that I can follow. It has saved my bacon many times, you know. There are so many times I can feel it coming up in my gut, and I just want to say, oh, and I don't, you know. And that will save me an amends later. It may save a relationship. You just don't know. Too many times when I've been drinking and in early sobriety, I have just let something come flying out of my mouth and I wish I could grab it and put it back, but you can't. So Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live. And it's by being willing to have a relationship with the God of my understanding. I get that by taking the steps and by practicing these principles in all my affairs and by having a relationship with you that I am able to be here today. So thank you for having me.